God of many names. Thank you for the hymn to begin with. My goodness, God of many names, hush, hush, hallelujah. It's begun my morning very well. President Gerbrandt, thank you so much for the introduction and the welcome. Dean Matisse, for leading us in prayer, and Professor Chris Hubner for bringing me in. I appreciate it so much, and my gratitude to the Thiessen family for an occasion that, whatever it is for you, for me it's an opportunity right on the edge of what I want to learn about. So at times I hope we can reverse who's speaking and who's listening. And on that note, for those of you who are able to attend any others of the lectures, I wanted to invite you, because of what I need to learn about very much for my work right now, to write down things that horrify you, concern you, question you, or that you want to question me. And either we'll have time after each talk to discuss them, or if you could give them to me, or perhaps to Chris, the fourth talk, I hope to do the second half of it by having read your questions, and then only then will I really know what I want to respond to your words. I look forward very much to the interaction. God of many names. Blessed shall you be in the city, and blessed shall you be in the country. Blessed shall be the offspring of your body, and the produce of your ground, and the offspring of your beasts, the increase of your herd, and the young of your flock. Blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed shall you be when you go out. Baruch atah ba'aretz, baruch atah b'tzeitcha, baruch atah b'sadeh, baruch atah b'yir. Blessed be you. I never met him in the flesh, but John Howard Yoder became a close friend of mine. I knew of him, to be sure, from the words of my living friend, the Christian theologian Stanley Hauerwas, but I also knew how much Mennonite faith was one of Hauerwas' ideals. But John Yoder became a close friend only after two things happened. The first was that the Yoder scholar Michael Cartwright asked Hauerwas and me if we would publish Yoder's The Jewish Christian Schism Revisited in the book series the two of us edited. We said yes, and Cartwright and I decided the book wouldn't be better in itself necessarily, and I know many of you may feel that, but it would fit our series if we appended to it our own Jewish and Christian commentaries, because the series is an Abrahamic series. So for those of you who wish our words weren't there a little bit, understand the context for bringing it into our series. And I appreciate it in both ways. So, all of a sudden, I was reading Yoder's work in depth, and then I began to make his acquaintance in a more intimate way. I listened to his arguments. I received some of them very happily, and a few of them made me want to argue back. I felt that Yoder and I, in this way, began to spar together like two wrestlers. If any of you has experienced sports, you know that sparring is a mixture of love and aggression. In the process, for myself, I began to become his friend. I became his close friend only after another event. Some scholars at Eastern Mennonite University, only an hour from my home in Charlottesville, Virginia, invited me to come speak about the Jewish Christian Schism Revisited, the book. I came, I spoke, I was engaged in deep conversation, and then I came again a few times. My relation to Yoder's words was still spicy. Some of his words I loved, and again, some of his words made me want to wrestle. But through this process at EMU, in agreement and disagreement, something else happened. My heart was opened and deeply warmed to the Mennonite community I was keeping. I spoke my mind and I listened. Over a little time, perhaps 1-3 years, I noticed some of my opinions changed. Not drastically, because I was still myself, but I had come a little closer each time to Yoder in my areas of disagreement at first. For their part, members of the EMU faculty and seminary students grew closer to one of my own projects. what we call inter-Abrahamic scriptural reasoning. It is a method for drawing Muslims, Christians, and Jews into fellowships of sacred text study. And as I often say before one of those sessions, this isn't something you should do regularly. You should go home and study in your own congregations. But once in a while, this is an important exercise. I want to say that again, lest you think, and we warn folks, this is not your home, scriptural reasoning. This is a meeting of our homes. Never forget that, we say in these sessions. And once in a while, we need to meet. If we meet too often, then we're never at home. If we meet too rarely, our homes have walls that are much, much too thick. In sum, then, I was drawn into fellowship with members of the Mennonite seminary community at EMU, and a few members of the community were drawn into fellowship with my Abrahamic once-in-a-while fellowship. And that's why I'm here today. I would have come to give one academic talk just because of my academic interest in this area and because, for me, of the importance of Chris Huebner's contribution to it. And you'll hear more about my reading of him in the second talk. But four public lectures, that's a great commitment. And despite the honor, I don't know if I would have accepted it if it weren't that I needed much more to learn, to strengthen and deepen my friendship with Yoder, and by that I mean, as I learned at EMU, with members of his religious community and tradition. And for that, I'm so, so glad, seriously, to be here. This leaves me one introductory point more to make. Why should I care to deepen this friendship? I trust that many of you offer yourselves in service to community, to family, to God, to peace, to caring for those in need. Whatever service you offer, you probably share my experience that the single greatest challenge to service in this world is energy. Every act of relationship, of thought, of caring, absorbs some of the limited energy God has given to us in this brief lifespan. Even if in God's grace our prayers open us to new foundations of strength, we remain earthbound, and the work and love we pour into life in any group limits the love we can pour elsewhere as well. So we have to make choices. Which best and most efficiently serves the good that I am given to serve? The reason I've taken time out of my own research and philosophy for Abrahamic dialogue, and the reason now, most intimately, is very important for me to take time for Mennonite Jewish dialogue, is that it is important to me personally, religiously, it's important to my service. And this, spoken extremely humbly on my side, less so in my voice on behalf of Yoder, I think that in that interaction, once in a while, there is something of profound and urgent importance for the West, for the civilization we inhabit, and for the unhappy relations of the Abrahamic peoples within it. I don't know why I found myself in this dialogue. It's beyond my comprehension. I found myself in it by some spirit. I know it, secondly, that what John Howard Yoder sought to reflect on in the early years of both Rabbinic Judaism and Christianity, because my Judaism, Rabbinic Judaism, emerged at the same time as Christianity. Neither are the religion of ancient Israel. Both emerged as reflections and commentaries on that religion in the face of great and defining suffering. Both are profound rereadings of the surface of that Old Testament tradition, of the Tanakh. They are profound rereadings of the surface. I don't believe they are rereadings of what is hidden in their depth, but rather through the rereadings on the surface, they open up what in different times and contexts lies at the depth. Well, for these four lectures, I want to imagine now that I remain in dialogue with this study of John Yoder's and with him. But I don't just mean John Yoder literally through these dialogues. As I suggested at the outset, I very much look forward to dialogue with you. It did not have to be. That is the title of the first chapter of Yoder's book. It is a remarkable chapter, introducing an unprecedented thesis that the Jewish-Christian schism, which Dean referred to, did not have to be because of at least four things. So I'm going to introduce you, if you haven't read Yoder's work on this area, I'm going to introduce you to those topics. If you have, well, that's the time to write me some notes of what you'd like me to talk about later. We cannot, Yoder writes, forget the Jewishness of Christianity, as if they somehow began as two different streams of history. There was only one stream of history, which later patristic, medieval, and modern Christians, as well as rabbinic and modern Jews, interpreted as if it had been separated from the beginning. This interpretation, Yoder continues, belongs to a story constructed over centuries to justify keeping the two apart. The story rests on the following claims, which are not, he says, historical, but ideological rereadings of history. So he's claiming that my ancestors and Christian ancestors reread the actual history ideologically to produce the following points, which he regards, therefore, as false. First, that there was a single normative Judaism born in ancient Israel and articulated by the rabbinic sages of the first few centuries, the rabbi's own construction, that he's saying is false. Second, that Jesus rejected this normative Judaism and was in turn rejected by it. He is claiming that is false. That the Apostle Paul once again rejected it and was rejected by it. He's claiming that's false. And finally, that Christianity is itself defined by these doubly mutual rejections, which means that wherever Jews and Christians shared in the first century, whatever they shared, it was far outshadowed by these differences. In reply, Yoder offers the following alternative reading of the history. Okay, so this is his position. And it's with this that I'm in dialogue. Usually warm, sometimes. Well, you've sweetened it, Chris. Number one, he argues, there was no single normative Judaism emerging out of the first century. Instead, the latter decades of Roman occupation was a time of radical upheaval with many movements vying for ascendancy among the Jews. By the end of the first century, the most significant of these, he writes, were the Messianic or Christian Jews and the rabbinic Jews. Second, he writes, neither Paul nor Jesus rejected normative Judaism first because there was no such norm. Second, because Jesus affirmed the historical stream of Judaism. I'll quote him directly. Yoder writes, what Jesus himself proposed to his listeners was nothing other than what he claimed as a normative vision for a restored and clarified Judaism, namely, the proper interpretation of the Jewish scriptures and tradition for this present in the light of the new age which he heralded. There is in the gospel accounts of the ministry of Jesus nowhere rejection of Judaism as a stream of history or a group of people. With regard specifically to the law, Jesus' attitudes are all affirmative. He came to fulfill the law, not destroy it, and to defend it against interpretations that would destroy its meaning or dull its edge. He placed himself fully within the history of Judaism. His third claim, his third answer, Yoder's. Similarly, and I quote him again, the Apostle Paul never rejected his claim that a true child of Abraham must share the faith in the Son of the promise made to Abraham. Those Israelites who had not seen Jesus, the promised one, were not thereby, for Paul, the mainline Jews. I'll say that again. This is the turning point. Those Israelites who had not seen Jesus were not thereby, for Paul, the mainline Jews or authentic Jews, but rather they were Jews not yet accepting the fulfillment of the promises made to their father. Paul debated head-on against certain ways of applying the Jewish heritage to the diaspora situation, the exilic life of the Jews. That was a debate which had been going on within Judaism already for generations. It was no way un-Jewish to debate whether or not we should live in exile or not, or anti-Jewish. Instead, through his mission, Paul was the great Judaizer of the Gentiles. Finally, Luther's last claim. The Jews did not reject Christianity. You may think there's another reason why I'm here, but we have to discuss this. Judaism as a system of beliefs and practices did not reject Christianity, he writes, as a belief system. Nor did Jewry as a body of people or most of their institution reject believers in Jesus as a people. The temple at Jerusalem was open to believers in Jesus until its destruction. The experience of clashes reported in Acts are not typical. Few of them are official, and they did not interrupt the continuing participation of believers in Jesus. Furthermore, outside of Jerusalem, there was no general expulsion of Christians from synagogues until the second century. The real division came later. In some, he writes, the standard account is wrong on all counts. Second claim. It didn't have to be. The second part of Yoder's thesis is that diaspora Judaism was classically pacifist, anti-nationalist, and messianic. Let me just check something, if I could, for the pace of my presentation to you. How many of you already know the argument and the text of the Jewish-Christian schism? Okay. Oh, good. So then I can read this. This is okay. Yeah. Good. I wanted to make sure. So I'll read a little slower. Okay. First claim again, so I'll review it for you, that for Yoder, the classic Jewish and Christian claim that Christianity isn't us, say the Jews, and that Judaism isn't us, say the Christians. Yoder's central claim in this book is that that was an ideological, self-interested development by religious political leaders over several centuries. There were differences within the Jewish community among those who were Nazarenes or early Christians and those who became rabbinic Jews, which was also a new movement in the first century. All right? So rabbinic Judaism, my Judaism, is a new movement in the first century, reinterpreting the Bible at that time. And he's saying Nazarene and then early Christian Judaism was a new movement of Judaism in the first century, reinterpreting. Is this clearer now? No, okay. Do you get the basic argument? Okay. Now we're looking at the second argument. Once he's saying there's differences, but they're more like denominational differences. Then if we re-look at the Jewish part of that unity and difference, the Jews were living in exile. What he's referring to is that in the year 70 of the first century, the Roman occupiers destroyed the Second Temple. So that's a defining date for rabbinic Jews. I'll put that off. I'm speaking tonight in detail about what happened to Judaism then to make it into the Judaism I practice rather than the ancient Israelites who wouldn't recognize me. Some other Jews don't recognize, but that's a different issue. We have our own debates. Okay. So I'll describe more of that tonight, but what he's assuming in this argument is that you kind of know that rabbinic Judaism started then, and he's looking then at the fact that after the year 70 until 135, the Jews, the Israelites in that sense, living in what was then called by the Romans Palestine, we'll come to that in the fourth lecture, were in great turmoil. Their temple was destroyed. The basis of their religion was destroyed. And during that turmoil, they were seeking to understand if they were dead as a religion. And there were many parties of intellectuals and leaders vying for influence in their work. So he's attending to that reality. And then in 135, after an uprising of these Jews against Roman occupation, the Israelite population will say, in that sense, the Jewish population of Jerusalem and of much areas around it in ancient Palestine were exiled from their land. Jerusalem was salted and destroyed. So we call the period in Jewish history from then on, and we can debate the 20th century later, we call that the diaspora, or the Jews living in Galut, in exile. And what Yoder is fascinated by, more than that, you'll see he's seeing his own church in, is that movement. That the people of the God of Israel not only were sent in suffering and victimhood away from their home, but that, and here's the point he lights on, the Jewish sages on the Jewish side of this dynamic accepted that condition, he argues, understood their religion as diasporic. And in understanding their religion as diasporic, they also understood their religion as pacifist. Since they had no home, they understood their religion as anti-nationalist. Since they still prayed for the return to the Holy Land, and since they now prayed that that return will be accompanied by universal peace, they were also messianic. Pacifist, anti-nationalist, messianic. That was classical Judaism. That is the center of Yoder's argument. And as you'll see, it sounds an awful lot like the Free Church. So Yoder concluded, I'm not done telling you about him, but he concluded that classical Judaism and the Free Church have very, very few differences. In fact, in relation to other churches with whom his Anabaptist ancestors and himself have great concern, classical Judaism is much closer to the Free Church than are many of the other churches. That's what I read as his argument. Now, how does he argue that? This will be where he and I, well, we're not on the same plane, where I both appreciate what he's saying, but have some questions to ask and look forward to your answers. Classical Judaism was exilic and messianic. The emblem of this claim for Yoder is that during the Babylonian, the earlier captivity, after the earlier destruction, right? The great prophet Jeremiah, the great teacher of the Israelites, preached in Jeremiah 29:7, "Seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find welfare." Yoder identifies that Jeremiah, I always forget how to do the adjective, one of those kinds of adjectival words, he identifies that Jeremiah Judaism as the essence of prophetic Judaism in exile, and ultimately as a Judaism that flowers again after the difficult time, in his words, of the Second Temple, that flowers again as diasporic Judaism. He therefore regards to exile and that compete for ascendancy after the destruction of that second, he regards many of those Judaisms as less essentially, less truly Jewish than the Jeremiac one. And it's that true Judaism that he identifies as ancestor of the Free Church. Second, therefore, classical Judaism was pacifist. Here is some of his argument. "Consider this," he said, "for the ancient Israelites, blood is sacred. Blood is the life and belongs to God. The blood of animals can be blood. Thirdly, Jewish thought learns the lessons of its own tendencies to zealotry, such as the Maccabees, and never wants to turn that way. And their interpretations, fourth, of the Bible to downplay violence, which is the case in those texts, and to delegitimize it in their own legal rulings Among the volumes of the Talmud, the great teachings of the rabbinic sages, of great law, there is a continual effort to respect the plain surface sense of the words about capital punishment, but never to enact them. That is, to add so many conditions and restrictions that it was impossible to enact capital punishment. So one of the arguments among many Jewish pacifists is that the rabbis had protected the surface words, but had put new wine in those words if you mix it. And Yoder is attending to that dimension of Talmudic heritage. Finally, he argues that there is, in rabbinic Jewish understanding, a place for suffering in the divine economy, that the faithful must suffer under the benevolence of a sovereign God is a mystery not yet clarified, but always true. We expect in this diasporic world that we will at times suffer at the hands of the Gentiles among whom we live. His point then in conclusion was that since the rabbis shunned violence, they must have recognized that they would suffer without the capacity for vengeance. Finally, and I won't take time to go through the details of it now, he argues that classical Judaism was therefore anti-nationalist, was messianic, was missionizing, and certainly was anti-clerical, because it had no temple and no active priesthood. And the foundation of rabbinic Judaism was a priesthood of all believers, and it's, put that into the English language, was that the priest of our religion is really the head of every household, in a sense, and the main altar, metaphorically in many ways, in rabbinic Judaism, and that's true of my Judaism, the main altar, in a sense, is the dining room table, where you break bread, and on the holidays, you break bread and drink wine. Think about that. It didn't have to be. Yoder's thesis is a powerful challenge to very old ways of separating Judaism and Christianity, and I wish it were true. After all, as you noted in my books, I spend so much time in Jewish-Christian dialogue. If his thesis were true, it would complete my work. I want that to be the case. But my wants are human, and some dimensions of the materials he's dealing with are not. And my concern with his thesis is not with its heart, with its love, with its adoration of the God of many names and the hope to bring us together. That's what I hope for. But I also share the spirit with which he made his arguments. And the arguments of the book, when they're arguments, are historical. He's saying, let's stop the ideological covering over of the truth. And unfortunately, I said that ingenuously, unfortunately, at a few times, his work achieves its synthesis by covering over some of the historical truths. What he's largely correcting is the illusion that Jack Neusner, the rabbinic scholar, and Daniel Bayarin and others have affirmed this aspect of Yoder's work, and he got it partly from Neusner. What he's correcting is a historical error to think that something like, for example, suburban conservative Judaism came straight from the first century, and that's what all the Jews were doing, what they do in the synagogues. He was saying, no, that was one of many kinds of Judaism competing. And maybe the ones who won, in a sense, within Judaism look like the rabbinic Jews that you see as your neighbors or in movies. But that was only one of the options. Therefore, he's not saying that that option is not a possible one. He's saying, but it doesn't mean that historically it will end up to be shown to be the truest one. Well, is he saying that the truest one is Christianity as we know it? And here I know you all know this thesis of his. Well, if I say it right, but you correct me quickly. That no, Constantinian Christianity, the Christianity of nations, and of doctrines that are immovable, that replace the immediate presence of Jesus Christ in the lives of Christians and the implications of those teachings, and replace the work of peace and of bearing down, of pulling down those waters, that Christianity is no truer either. So he's saying, don't think, O Jews, that I'm simply repeating the old Christian effort to missionize you. I'm just as difficult, or even more, to my own Christian fellows. I'm arguing with you on behalf of the God of Israel. He's arguing that your comfortable Judaism and many of our European neighbors' comfortable Christianity may not, in fact, be the will of God. And I see in the Free Church, he argues, and in diasporic rabbinic Judaism that has been covered over a bit by later Judaisms, I see in those two, I'm animating him, personifying him, I see in him through my prayers and my critical study of history, theology, what God wanted. Do you like that? Do you hope for that? And I'm going to focus on what ultimately concerns me in his vision, and then invite you to challenge me back. Without going through the details, I want to suggest to you that many of the historical claims he's making, I think, are verified by subsequent rabbinic scholarship. But what isn't verified are the following. That one has the capacity through the scholarship today, through historical scholarship, to say that Jeremiah's prayer that while they're in Babylonia, the Jews should bless their neighbors and stay. It's not possible to say historically that that was the dominant reading of Jeremiah himself, who prayed continually for the return to Jerusalem, and his great disciple Ezekiel, who is, I think, the founder of Second Temple Judaism and of Biblical Judaism, brought Judaism back, ancient Israelite Judaism, I mean, back to the Holy Land. There is no evidence of such a strong historical stream of separating the land of Israel, in other words. I'm not talking about nationhoods in contemporary history. I'm talking about that. I'm talking about the land of Israel. There is very, very, very thin evidence that any of the sages or the prophets wish for, hope for, prayed for, separating Israelite prayer from life in that land. So if we're going to go that way, dear John Yoder, we have to face the much more difficult task I'll raise in the fourth talk, end of the third, of dealing with the land in a non-schismatic way, by which I mean, don't assume, and now I'm speaking, I hope, in the spirit of Yoder, don't assume that there are only two options. That there's either life in the land with, God forbid, the walls that you know I'm referring to, and that that's a theocracy, and it controls its own destiny, and it has a vision of greater Israel. Don't assume that the options are that and ghettos of Jews, or however they're received, living only outside the land. Because such separations, the very notion of separation that's involved in the schismatic understandings of classical Judaism and Christianity, separations are only made by humans. Separation is the sign and the test of whether or not an action has been human or divine. So it could not have been God's will to think in such binary ways and to think that soil and land is incompatible with human flesh and with a divine spirit. My goodness, if that were the case, what is incarnation? So, in that voice, my first concern is that John Yoder follow only his own spirit a touch more completely, and not in the haste of making this thesis work conceptually and historically so quickly and all sealed up. Go quicker, and I'm learning this language of haste from Chris, from his book on Yoder. And go in such haste that the peace you've arrived at is a peace imagined by humans, but not served by the bread of God's presence. My first concern is that I agree with John Yoder that what separates us are human ideologies and constructions. I believe with him that God alone is the agent of peace, literally, and that we overcome our human distances from each other when they're separate only through the literal presence of God between us and in us, not even through our hopes for it. I agree with that. I pray for that. But therefore, any writing, preaching, dialogue, activity, hope that focuses its energy, its good energy, on overcoming schism, won't I be reading John Yoder from other works correctly if I say that any of those activities, if they serve peace, will display in themselves to us the divine presence alone, in whom and with whom we can be bound in peace? Okay. Then, Peter, that's my name, how do you know from a Jewish perspective that that divine present isn't there? If I don't know, because knowledge, yidiyah in Hebrew, means intercourse, meaning most intimate presence with one another. The fleshly kind is only a pale image of the one I'm referring to. Though it's one too, or material religion. Knowledge is not, oh yes, I know that. Knowledge is. And if we talk about cognitive issues like philosophy, knowledge is this too. It's not identity, because identity isn't love between two. It's a getting rid of difference. Knowledge, in my understanding of rabbinic Judaism, isn't identity, which is wiping away difference. It's this. And if we're speaking of philosophic knowledge or cognitive or academic knowledge, and what does yidiyah mean? It's knowledge that's not just in our own heads and that cannot be understood by any one of us alone. It's knowledge that we understand only in dialogue with each other, not because I have an opinion and you do, but because we trust that God has made us different so that in the dialogue between us, something will arise which we haven't seen before. And that's knowledge. And it'll have emotive characteristics because we live in the flesh. It'll have logical characteristics. My interest is the logic of that, my own technical interest, is the way, what forms of scientific logics can understand what arises when two people are in dialogue. So all I'm suggesting to you is, if someone said to me, well, how do you know that this conception of Jewish-Christian unity is not fully expressing the peace of God? I don't know for sure, because knowledge is something, it depends on the other, and I'm interacting, so I have to be here this week to make sure and to strengthen my feelings about this. But, I say, we go by certain symptoms which we've learned in our prayers and in our religious study and in our preaching that warn us that what you're about to enter may not be a divine region. And you test. And the greatest symptom I've learned to test such things is brittle, clear, and distinct difference. That is, when two people in dialogue have a conceptually fully clear conception of their own position, and the two positions are crystal clear and they exclude each other, whatever they are, I can't read that dialogue as displaying God's presence. Why? Because to be clear and to have a full, clear conception of something means to have a finite mind, because clarity means graspable in a finite way. We cannot burden God with clarity, because we cannot burden God with that which is apparent only in finitude. Therefore, the clearer we are cognitively of our faith and our difference from each other, the more we know what we see isn't bad, but it's very human. So if I speak in human terms and say anthropologically, we are this group who speak Yiddish, and we are this group who speak another kind of German, right? Great, we are different, and we can be clear about the grammars of those languages and about our two homes. That's human, and it's good. We were made as creatures. But if we're claiming to speak about the divinity that binds us together and that overcomes our differences, and if our description of that coming together retains clarity, you see what I'm saying? Then I don't see that part of the vision is consistent with what it claims. If we know exactly how peace will work, we know a human thing. If we know peace in the intercourse, you know, that kind of way, it means that, if you will, the Prince of Peace, the God of Peace, is here. And we engage. And we can speak about it, but it won't be clear. It'll be what? Dialogic. When I say not clear, I don't mean, I don't know, it's mystery, we'll never know. No, God came to give us his word. It's that finite humans see that word through their interactions and dialogue and relations, so that no one of them speaks it clearly, but the two together live it clearly. And the sign of their living it clearly is what I heard in the hymn at the beginning of this evening, this morning. God of many names, lumen web of love. That's knowledge, if you declare that from your experience of one another. So therefore, to conclude this morning, John Yoder's work animates and thrills and excites me with hope and prayer. The one, simply one element of it which disappoints me is the times when he rushes beyond the evidence to clarify a good thing falsely. I don't mean falsely too sharply, but just, that's too strong a word. No, you're not false, okay? I take back. I withdraw the false word. It's too clear a word, because I don't mean it. But I'm trying to say that there's more work to be done. That's what I mean. I'll say two more things, okay? I have lots of things to say here, but I thought, we'll discuss it. Second, I love his work. He cites friends of his like Stephen Schwarzschild, and he quotes Stefan Zweig. I don't think writing about a schism in the prayer that it be reduced can be done individually. If Yoder's words were presented in a 5-day conference among 30 of us working on this day and night, but not written, and then those words were reacted to by the rest of us, and we prayed, and we studied, and we checked our logics, and we did philosophy, and we prayed, and we studied, and we prayed scripture. At the end of the week, I don't know if any statement could be made, but what I meant to say was that those 20 people might more closely embody in their speech with each other, not just emotions, in their speech with each other, in their thinking, a reduction of the schism. But this is not something you can do alone, because by yourself, all you can do is be clear or have no readers. I tried to publish a book of dialogues. It sold 50 copies, and the publisher said, never again. There are some famous people you're teaching this morning named Plato who can sell dialogues. But that wasn't a dialogue. It was his own writing, so it works. You can't sell actual dialogues, but you can live them. And that's knowledge. So my second of the last 3 points is that yes, even everything you said, John, is right if it were spoken in dialogue and we interacted and something came out of it. So I turn to your students and disciples who are here and who are doing a similar argument, but we can talk about it, or my students can talk. And finally this. The book that Dean mentioned that I've just done with Brazos isn't out yet, but it's in printing, called Another Reformation, Post-Liberal Christianity and the Jews. That book is about a what is in my mind a community of Christian scholars who, as I see them, not necessarily that they agree, but they, none of them minded. I sent them all, except for John, the chapters on them. And they said, it's a little not exactly me, but I wish it were, or something like that. You know. So I'll close with what I saw in them, and I included John Yoder among them. I gave them a name, Posen or Bull. Who cares about those funny names? I saw a company of Christian scholars who looked around at churches that were either tradition-bound and doctrinal and separate from one from the other, or were kind of too loosey-goosey, I'm using relaxed words, if you will, you know, were loosey-goosey, you know, sweetly assimilating into Western reason kind of churches. And all these scholars, Hauerwas and Lindbeck, Milbank is there too, though with some criticisms, and Yoder, that all of them are saying to those two sides of the church, no. And then they're saying, you ask me what will follow the no, what yes? Read scripture, read the divine word, be philosophic, intellectual, thoughtful, of course. But out of reading the divine word, you're a church after all, not a university. Okay. And then the next thing that happens for all of those thinkers, except for John Milbank, they rediscover not only Christ in scripture and in the flesh, they rediscover that that Jesus who is Christ for them is just characterized and is given witness to in a book which is always, continually, and never finished, a rereading of the Old Testament. And they rediscovered that the place in the church that is not divided this way or this way is a place when we are taught not just to witness gospel and reread the Old Testament, but taught by that practice. You see the practice? Word reinterpret. We are taught that, in these words, Christian knowledge, or for me, Jewish knowledge, is participating in a dynamic cycle of life and reinterpretation of the divine word. It's neither ignoring that word nor grasping it in a simple sentence. That, if John Yoder is saying that, which he is, that is exactly my Judaism. Thank you.
Michael Wadlinger, Chosen People Ministries. I'm most interested right now in your perceptions, and I'm wondering if you believe it exists, what role does the current Messianic Jewish community have in this schism, in bringing together the church and the Jewish community?
Thank you for the question. I hear that question as both the kind of theological question we might ponder as theologians in a room together, but also as a public theopolitical question. Because what we found in this business, that what we do outside our separate meeting rooms has public force and affects judgments and affects relationships among churches and synagogues. So one thing I'm not prevaricating, because I face a similar issue when we are engaging in Muslim Jewish Christian dialogue, which I'll speak about in another talk. And I'm engaged, for example, by an Ibadi or other Muslim group, which I know that group angers the dominant Sunni groups that I work with. What do I do? I love that individual group. Theologically, I think it has great significance. I'm thinking of an Ahmadi, for example, if anybody knows the Ahmadis. You know, these are sects in Iran which the government excludes violently. What do I do if I'm working in a group whose, we think, whose religious passion is to bring not just those of us who already think together, but to do something that really brings traditional folks who don't agree with each other, well, it's very much what I learned from you, but, you know, together. What do I do if my own, or my students' or others' activities of love anger some of the people we're working with? It's an issue of justice, but it's also an issue of the complex judgment we make about how, at what point in history, to do what, where, theopolitically. So, you see where I'm going. When I engage individually, or my students, or such groups, Messianic churches, I won't say I'm at home, because that's a public lecture, but I did mean that. I'm very happy, and I feel I'm in a place of significant theological movement. But while we haven't shied away from individual members of our dialogue groups, who are Messianic Jews, I don't think that we're going to achieve our peace goal in the next decade or few. I mean, not that we'll achieve them, but in this immediate period, I don't think it's time yet. I think it would dissuade others who otherwise we want to have put down their arms from coming to our circle. So that's my long answer to you, because I want to be sensitive to it.
My name is Gordon Zerbe. I teach scripture at CMU, and I think the questions you've raised for us in general is what constitutes a historical reading, and to what use, perhaps theological use, can this reading be applied? Since Yoder's procedure is to develop a historical reading that he applies theologically. And it seems to me that all historical readings themselves are in the context of a home, which complicates matters for us. And it seems to me, in some respects, that we should not only have societies of scriptural reasoning, but societies of historical reasoning. Since even describing the first century is fraught with all kinds of dilemmas, because even to label anything is entirely inappropriate insofar as using the labels even of Christian and Jewish in the first century. So that for me is an interesting, and it raises then the question, is in a sense Yoder's more general enterprise somewhat fraught with difficulty, because at a certain point he assumes that historical readings are somewhat neutral in a certain sense. And maybe if I can even sort of one more thing. As a Christian scripture scholar, I also find that every now and then I can't twist the New Testament to always come out right for me, which constitutes some very grave difficulties. And just speaking for a moment about Jeremiah's diasporic comment and how Yoder applies that, I've actually come to the conclusion that images of the restoration of the land is implicitly found throughout the pages of the New Testament, and in fact, every now and then, in fact, coming to the surface, which is something that Christians, of course, have had to submerge and not to acknowledge, but it has to do with that question of the separation between the diasporic and the restoration images, which we have tried to pull apart. Now, the problem is, if I broadcast too much, that means I buy into a certain form of Christian dispensationalism, perhaps, which I'm not interested in. But it does raise some interesting questions that are sort of interesting for both scriptural and historical reasoning purposes. So,
both questions so far, uncover the heart of both what concerns me, what attracts me, of the issues. This one on the, I'd say academic or empirical side. I wanted to ask you about the references to restoration. What if the scholars you're working with say, but those New Testament references and perhaps the prophetic ones are messianic, that is, they're not meant to be, you know, the Jews should walk on that soil until the end of time. Are you suggesting that you take those not to be the end of the time between the time claims?
That's a very, the way I understand the rhetoric of restoration beginning in the prophets and into Ezekiel, where the imagery gets very grand, is they're all oriented to that time of restoration. It's simply that in there's a sense in which the land is still the place for now, even though the imagery, it seems to me, is especially for some future. And so, in a sense, the imagery in the New Testament is more clearly futuristic, okay. Quite granted.
I raise that because it's often offered back to me when I say, well, the reference to the land, they say, yes, but that doesn't mean the one you can ever put your feet on, Peter, at least not in this world. Two responses, one theological then and one more about academics. The theological one is that in one of the talks I'm doing, I think it's the third, yes, the third, and a little the second, I talk a lot about the Hebrew notion of Shabbat, the Sabbath, as being a name for the end time. It is Gan Eden. It is, the Sabbath is the end of days. At the same time, it's something we actually touch and do and live, literally fully here, only not every day, not every minute. So my eschatological sense is shaped by that notion. So this is just from my own Jewish theological perspective. I don't think that the messianic notion of the land contradicts or is even realizable without a this-worldly notion of the land. The problem for me is when the this-worldly notion of the land thinks it's an end-time notion. That is, when it thinks it's total and done and finished and right and triumphant. And that's what I'm hoping for. Well, either way, I'm either hoping that in dialogue with you, for example, I'll be persuaded, as I've moved a little bit at EMU, and then I'll be at peace, even if others may think I'm wrong, or that I'll discover in dialogue with you that there is a third way to approach this issue of the land, like the Sabbath, a way for our feet to be in soil and our hearts to be not in soil. And that's what I'm praying for. We'll talk about that later. On the academic side, finally, and I have to ask you, I didn't read a lot of more technical, they weren't technical, but I didn't read detailed parts of my talk that'll appear, I think, somewhere, because I didn't know if how many of you were used to this theme in the book, so I went a bit slower. And I only say that because in some of those greater details, what I agonize over is the place of academic, empirical, sort of scientific thinking. It's what part of the material here is about. What's the place of that in our Christian or Jewish or interreligious argumentation? And what I come to, which is only not clear yet, hopefully, by myself, but I'd much want to talk to you. Oh, excuse me, I have to say, well, I'll do my exclamation in a second. I'll finish my sentence. What I come to is a notion that, of course, God needs every bit of our cognition and science, everything we have, to serve his will. But we have to figure out a little better how what's become a very self-defined academic reasoning in our universities, unlike what it was in the universities perhaps before Berlin in the 19th century, 18th century. Anyway, we have to figure out a little better what are the signs that indicate we are putting our academic sharpness in the service of the divine word, or to the contrary, we're just plastering it on top of one on top of the other. And I think one element in this book of Yoda's is that he's appealing to justification from academic readers by appealing to an empirical historiography, which is a dangerous tool because it can be then used in some ways against him. And I don't blame him, though, because I'm imagining that it's very recently that some of our disciplines, some of you young folks won't feel this because you've been given it by your teachers, but we who were there when it wasn't know what it feels like. What I'm trying to say is in some of our disciplines, we're beginning to have a way that you can teach, even in the public university, write books, get tenure, but know that science itself isn't subjective. It's that it has many names, like many names of God. That is, science has schools, and those schools are connected to certain lived politics, and we can be aware of that. And once we have a better sense of the embeddedness of our academic pursuits in larger normative claims, we can't clarify what he was trying to do. So yes, we have to know what our communities that we're serving while when we do our historiography. And Deuteronomy may have been one of the first ones to try that. The great Deuteronomic historian who was a believer. And you know, okay, so the questions I most need to hear from you in writing or otherwise are questions like the following. Does it make any difference to you in your church life to have a Jewish-Christian schism or to hear about connections to the Jews? And then second, I'll just do one more, but just a brief one. Do you yourselves see, either in the church or in the broader Western society, do you see the dilemma that some of us are running around, you know, like Chicken Little, yelling is the problem, namely, too much strictly human-centered judgments being cast out as a source of our peace? That I'd very much like to hear. What you feel about that, the difference between humanly conceived peace and divinely offered peace. Because if it isn't an issue to you, then it'll sound a little bit like I'm sort of squawking. And then I can at least squawk more quietly.
I maybe didn't answer earlier, but in fact, in pre-70 New Testament writings, the importance of legitimacy of current land is very definitely affirmed.
And that's certainly the early Jewish Christian church, the Messianic church in that sense, and quite comfortably so.
This ending to this session reminds me of that old adage, when you're writing a sermon or writing an essay and you want to finish, make sure you stop, that is if you have to continue tomorrow, make sure you stop at the point where the next very creative line is already on your tongue or on your pen. It's like why can't we just keep going, right, through lunch? In any case, you must come back now, of course, because your appetite has been whetted, to come back tonight at 7:30 to the second lecture, Biblical Israel, Rabbinic Judaism, and Sola Scriptura. Thank you, Dr. Oakes, for your stimulating engagement, for your heartfelt embrace of our presence here today. And I just hope that we can reciprocate and make this a truly fruitful dialogue. Thank you again very much.